This episode of Tales from the Lot is sponsored by ShakedownT-Shirts.com with unique lot style t-shirts, license plate frames, coffee mugs, and all sorts of things for Grateful Dead, Fish, Zappa, Panic, and more. ShakedownT-Shirts.com, where all U.S. orders over $35 ship free. And just for Tales from the Lot listeners, use the code LOT20 for 20% off of any order. That's LOT20. Hey, real quick, before we kick off this episode of Tales from the Lot, I've got some exciting news to share with you. I've been working on a project called Summer Tour The Game, inspired by our love of following our favorite bands around. It's a tabletop board game where you chase shows, collect ticket stubs, and relive the magic of live music, all from your own tabletop. I'm thrilled to announce that the Kickstarter campaign for Summer Tour The Game is launching on May 12th. If you're a fan of this podcast, then I think you're really going to enjoy this game. You can check out a short video and all the details at summertourthegame.com. So whether you're a seasoned road warrior or a tabletop gaming enthusiast or just looking for a new way to connect with friends, I invite you to check out the campaign and consider supporting it. Every pledge and share and word of encouragement makes a difference. I'd love it if you would help spread the word and make Summer Tour The Game a reality. Thank you, everyone, for listening and being a part of this journey, and now on with the episode. Tales from the Lot, episode 23, People Were Taking Care of Each Other. My guest is Bill Bigelow, and if you've ever wondered what it was like at the Grateful Dead beginnings of the late 60s, you're going to want to listen to this one. We did have some technical difficulties in the beginning that I think I made worse by trying to fix them, so apologies for the noise, but you will want to get through this one. Here we go.
Hi, welcome to Tales from the Lot. This is Will. My guest today is Bill Bigelow from Portland, Oregon. How are you doing today, Bill?
I'm good. Thanks, Will. Thanks for inviting me.
For sure. And so you're in Oregon now, but you're saying you're from the Bay Area originally. Is that where you're kind of born and raised?
I grew up in Marin and then lived all over the Bay. I lived in Berkeley for a spell. I lived in Kentfield. I lived next door to the new Riders of the Purple Sage on Hermit Lane in Kentfield when Garcia played pedal steel with them. And I lived up in Inverness Park in the Point Reyes area and Sleepy Hollow. So all over Marin.
Oh, wow. Yeah, such a great area. Growing up, what were you into musically? Like, what were you listening to like through high school? And how did you find the Grateful Dead?
Yeah, good question. You know, I listened, you know, I was in seventh grade when the Beatles sort of hit. And so I was a big Beatles fan. I went to the Beatles at the Cow Palace in 1964 when they first came to San Francisco. I still have my Welcome KEW Beatles banner. I spent my sophomore year of high school in Switzerland, and I only had two record albums over there. One was Freewheelin' Bob Dylan, and the other was Highway 61. So those were sort of, you know, it was kind of Dylan was sort of my anchor music, and the Beatles. And then we got back in 67, just as, you know, everything was exploding in the Bay Area and the Fillmore and the Avalon. And that was a great time to be in high school.
Yeah, no doubt. Highway 61, particular favorite of mine. When did you first see the Dead, and how did you end up there?
You know, my very first concert, my friend Ned Leathers, I just want to give a plug to Ned, who is no longer living. But Ned just had such great musical taste and just sort of began taking me along. And I can't even believe that my mother let me go. But on May 15th, 1968, at the Carousel Ballroom at the corner of Market and Van Ness in San Francisco, later became the Fillmore West, the Hells Angels had a concert with Big Brother and the Holding Company as headliners, and the Young Bloods and a little group called Rejoice. It was a dollar. It said no minors. I was like 16 or whatever I was then, but you know, they weren't checking IDs. And so I felt like, you know, I had kind of discovered the meaning of life. I'd never seen anything like Janis Joplin and Big Brother before. And so Ned and I began going to concerts pretty much every weekend and sometimes more. And the Dead at that point, that was in the little sliver of time when the Dead and the Airplane and Quicksilver and Big Brother were running the Carousel Ballroom. And then Bill Graham had the original Fillmore over on Fillmore Street. And so I began seeing the Dead at the Carousel. And they were uneven, you know. I can remember one time going, and there might have been like maybe a couple hundred people there or so. And I remember turning to Ned and saying, God, I hope that they can get some enthusiasm up with so few people. And so those were before there was anything called Deadheads.
Wow, that's some great bands to see at that time.
It was an amazing time, and you know, I don't know if you've talked on your show about Bill Graham, and you know, you kind of had to love him and hate him, you know, because he was a mean SOB, and he. But on the other hand, you knew that if at a Bill Graham organized concert. You know, they were going to start on time. You were going to get three bands with doing a set each. And then they were all going to start again. And they were going to play at least until 2 a.m, if not more. And so in some ways it was a wonderful thing to have this kind of, you know, I don't know what, this kind of a capitalist pig there running the Fillmore West. So, and Winterland, right. Winterland too.
You mentioned, you know, if we have talked about him on the show, and it seems like the few times that he has come up, it's been in sort of like he was kind of a hard ass to whoever he was interacting with, you know.
You know, he was a hard ass, but here's the deal. You know, he loved the Grateful Dead. I mean, he had a love-hate relationship probably with the Grateful Dead because he was a quintessential businessman, and, you know, and the Dead were sort of they lived in opposite land, right? But on the other hand, Bill Graham totally appreciated the Dead. One of my favorite quotes from Bill Graham about the Dead is that the Grateful Dead are not the best at what they do. They're the only ones who do what they do. And I think that just captured it perfectly that, you know, there was nobody like the Grateful Dead. And, you know, and Bill Graham, you know, I imagine that the Dead played for Bill Graham, you know, as much as they played for anybody, you know? And so, but yes, he was a problematic fellow.
So did you keep seeing the Dead all through their history?
So my first Dead concerts were in 1968. And it was really in that period of 68, 69, 70, and 71 that I saw them all the time. I think that my last Dead concert was in Eugene at Austin Stadium in 87 when they were touring with Bob Dylan. And it was a whole different scene, you know, when they became so big that they, you know, that they were playing stadiums. And for me, that was kind of, you know, not my Grateful Dead experience. And so, you know, I mean, you know, the music stayed great, but the experience was not kind of the intimacy that I grew up with.
And that was sort of post Touch of Grey too. So.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, one of the great things about being in the Bay Area was that Jerry Garcia, I mean, he just played all the time, and it was just no big deal to go see Garcia. I mean, you could just kind of, you know, you could be sitting around, you know, dinner and say, oh, hey, let's go to Garcia tonight, and you know, see where's he playing, and oh, he's at the Matrix, or oh, he's at the Keystone Berkeley, and you know, and just go over and. You know, and it wasn't, again, it was, they weren't, he wasn't the big kind of, you know, rock and roll god that he became, you know?
Yeah, he certainly did become that. What are some of the standout ones that you saw from that 68 to 71 era?
It was in January of 71. And, you know, we decided to go over to Keystone Berkeley and see Garcia and with Merle Saunders. And, you know, Keystone Berkeley was just kind of a little hole in the wall. It was there on University Avenue, and it wasn't like a big, huge, you know, venue. It wasn't like the Fillmore or Winterland or anything like that. And we didn't know how long it took to drive from, you know, Point Reyes and Inverness, where we were. And so we left. We got there early. And when we got there, there was kind of, you know, really nobody there. And they took our money or whatever. We just walked in. And there was nobody in there except for the Grateful Dead. The entire Grateful Dead was there with Merle Saunders on stage, you know, just kind of rehearsing, doing a sound check or whatever. And so, you know, I mean, we weren't even 21, but we, you know, we got a pitcher of beer. We got this little table. We sat in the front row and just kind of kicked back and listened to the Grateful Dead play to us. And so that was a wonderful experience.
Yeah, that's amazing. Was there some interaction? I mean, like, were they appreciative?
Yeah, you know, there was always interaction in the small. I mean, I remember one time at the Carousel. I don't think it was when the Fillmore West had started there yet. I think it was still the Carousel. And you know, and the Dead came out, and we would always get there early, so you could just kind of, you could really lean on the stage. I mean, the stage was just not that tall at the Carousel or Fillmore West. It was, you know, might have been like, you know, 3.5 feet tall or something, and so you could just lean on it. And Bobby Weir came out with a plate of tuna fish sandwiches for us, and just sort of passed these little tuna fish sandwiches. And I was like, okay, that's cool. And, you know, if I was thinking about stories, one of the I don't know if you want to call it bittersweet, but contradictory stories. So I went one night. It was sort of a famous concert now, I think. It was May 29th, 1971. It was at Winterland. And a whole bunch of us went. And during the concert, they, you know, they passed out all this punch and, you know, juice or whatever, fruit juice. Mm-hmm. And it was all laced with acid. And I kind of had a sense that it was going to be, and I didn't have any. But everybody had a lot. And, you know, some people say that it was the Dead who had done this. Other people say, oh, no, the Dead would never dose anybody like that. But I think, of mm-hmm. course, they would. But it was, you know, a lot of people were taken to the hospital, and, one of the women who I was there with, she had way too much. She spun around and she just fell on the concrete, chipped her tooth. But one of the things about Bill Graham and those concerts, he had these rent-a-cops. And, you know, today you think about these kind of bully rent-a-cops, and these were sort of rent-a-cops who, they had seen it all. And so this one guy, he must have been like 250 or 300 pounds, a rent-a-cop. And this woman that I was with, who, I mean, everybody was just really acting crazy. They were screaming. He went up to her and he put his arms around her and he said, "Sweetheart, everybody loves you. Everything's going to be okay." And he actually went out into the middle of the street. This is right after the concert where everybody is kind of going crazy. And he stopped this Volkswagen bus, just stopped them, just stood in front of the bus. And he went up to the driver and he said, "You're going to take them." And he gave them the address of this hospital. He didn't ask them, "Would you?" He just instructed them. And so, you know, and so we went, and, you know, she was taken care of. And, but I think that that was sort of, you know, sort of the ethos is that, you know, even in kind of crises like that, that people were taking care of each other.
Hey there, wanderers of the open road. I invite you to say goodbye to the dull and hello to the dazzling with Golden Road GPS navigation, the ultimate guide to scenic, colorful, and spiritually uplifting routes. Have you ever been cruising down the highway, chasing the sunset and the next adventure, when suddenly you found yourself at a crossroads, unsure which path to take?
Crap, I have no idea where I am. I just want to get to the concert on time.
Fear not, fellow traveler. Golden Road. Navigation has got your back. With Golden Road, you'll embark on a journey like no other, guided by the voices of Bob Weir. St. Louis Street. Or Donna Jean. And coming soon, get ready to be serenaded by the one and only John Mayer. His voice may not guide you perfectly, but hey, at least it'll be entertaining. So why settle for ordinary navigation when you can take the scenic route with Golden Road GPS navigation?
You know, my favorite one that I listen to it every week. I mean, is from August 6, 1971. I didn't go, but I had a second generation reel-to-reel copy of the tape. And, you know, it's just like, you know, Garcia is just kind of talking to God, you know? I mean, he's just, you know, and it's just so beautiful and it's so powerful. And you just know that people's lives were changed that night. And it was like, I mean, the Dead could be, you know, Dead had plenty of off nights, but with their on nights, it was like, it was just like so spectacular and you know, like nothing ever.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
I remember going to one of those, you know, early concerts when it would have either been at the Carousel or in the early days of the Fillmore West. And, you know, it was before, you know, after a while, it became like the Dead could do no wrong. They could get up there and they could do anything. And people would kind of scream and, you know, applaud and, you know, give them standing ovations. But everybody was just kind of sitting. And I think probably they were playing Dark Star. And then Dark Star kind of moves into St. Stephen. And then there's that moment in St. Stephen, you know, it kind of starts out gentle. And then they just crash into it. And it was just as one, the audience just rose and just, you know, and it's like, you know, the Dead could just take you places that, you know, that only the Dead could take you.
That's like right after the lady finger part. Lady finger. Yeah.
It crashes right in. Yeah.
See, you were seeing it with Pigpen.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, for me, that there is no Grateful Dead without Pigpen. You know, I mean, he was, you know, obviously Love Light, but so many, I mean, it was a great, I know that it's sort of controversial, but you know, the period when Tom Constantin, which I might be mispronouncing his name, but when he came in around the Live Dead period, and so Pigpen sort of got moved off the organ onto kind of the congas and still played a really important role in singing. You know, he was the life of the party.
Yeah, I believe it.
It's funny, you know, I don't know that any of us knew that he was sick. I don't know that any of us knew that he was really kind of getting sick during all that period. And so, you know, it was, I mean, he used to really, you know, his organ was very center. It was a big place, a big part of the music. And obviously then it became less so. And, you know, after Tom Constantin, I guess that the next keyboard player must have been Keith Godshaw who came in. I remember the first time, I think it was probably the first time that Keith Godshaw played with them in San Francisco. We went to the Harding Theater, and there's a video or a CD of it now, you know, that, well, there's CDs of everything now, I guess. But so the Harding Theater was not a usual music venue. It was this kind of, you know, sort of movie theater, I guess, on Divisadero in San Francisco. And so it was, it would have been November of 1971. And so I think that Keith Godshaw began playing with them just a brief period before that. But it was interesting because I liked him, but the Dead at that, it was kind of like he slowed them down a little bit, that it it was almost like he was sort of having to still learn the songs at that point.
There's a lot of songs.
That was before. Yeah, there were a lot of songs, right? A lot of songs, yeah. But that was before Donna began singing with them.
Did you consider going to the Winterland shows in 74, the farewell shows or whatever?
You know, I in 74, you know, I was an Antioch College student in Ohio. So I did go to all the last days of the Fillmore. In fact, you can see Bill Graham walking right by me in that film. I'm in line there. And actually a bunch of my friends, my then friend, Kim Mitchell, her beautiful blonde hippie face kind of fills the screen at one point. You know, like, this is just to tell you about Jerry Garcia. So Garcia, so it's the Rowan Brothers are opening, and then it's New Riders of the Purple Sage, and then it's the Grateful Dead. And so they're going to play, it's going to be six sets total, right, at Fillmore West. And so Garcia plays pedal steel with the Rowan Brothers. Garcia plays pedal steel with New Riders of the Purple Sage. And then Garcia plays lead with the Grateful Dead. And then he starts over and does it all again. So Garcia plays every single set from like 8 p.m. or 8:30, whenever it started, till, you know, 2 or 3 in the morning. And, you know, it's just like, you know, the boy loved music. What can I say?
Yeah, I mean, that's hungry.
Yeah, it's really, yeah. And, you know, and I mean, he was just playing pretty much every night of the week. And I brag about this to whoever will listen. But my favorite address of any places I've ever lived is on Hermit Lane in Kentfield. And so Kentfield, it's really like within walk. It's like 5 or 10 minutes at the most from College of Marin. But it's this beautiful little kind of, you know, dense tree area. It's a dirt road. And there were only two houses there. There was our house and there were New Riders of the Purple Sage. It's when, I don't know if it's like Marmaduke whose house it was, but their rehearsal room, the New Riders rehearsal room, was their living room. And so it was right next door to ours. And so, and my room kind of was on that side of the house. So I could literally lie on my bed and just kind of just hang out there and listen to Jerry's pedal steel come in through my window. So, wow. I mean, it was both the greatest place to live, but also, you know, just musically is how lovely to live right next door to them. It was when I actually got, I was working with the Marin Peace Coalition. I was doing anti-war work at the time. This is, the spring and summer and into the fall of 1971. And so I went next door, knocked on the door, and asked them if they would do a benefit for the Marin Peace Coalition and this Marin County People's Food Co-op that we were organizing as sort of an alternative to the capitalist Safeway and other food stores. And they said, yeah, sure. And, you know, go to our office and here's our manager is Sam Cutler, and talk to Sam and he'll set it up and tell him that we said yes. And so I did. I went to the Grateful Dead's office in Santa Fe, and Garcia was there and just kind of hanging out, and Bill Kreutzmann was there, and the best sound system I've ever heard in my life to this day was in that office in San Rafael, which I don't know, maybe it's possible they still have it. But, and so, you know, we met with Sam Cutler and set it up and worked on the dates and got it all arranged. And ultimately they said that they had a conflict and they backed out of it. But, anyway, it was my moment in the Grateful Dead's inner sanctum.
That's a great moment.
It was a great moment. And also it was a cool moment, you know, I mean, because it was just kind of Jerry and me just kind of sitting in the office, and he's opening his mail and, you know, these checks, whatever it was, you know, $200 from the the, you know, Keystone, you know, Berkeley or whatever. But they were playing the Dead. I mean, they were playing their own stuff, in there. And it was just, it was so crisp that you really couldn't tell that they weren't right there playing it. I mean, I've never heard a sound system that good before. You know, they were always changing. And, you know, you see a film like Grateful Dog, you know, the Jerry and David Grisman. And, you know, they just loved all music. I mean, they loved bluegrass. They loved blues. They loved country and Western. And the other thing, and this is, you know, it was definitely true of the Dead. I mean, they weren't trying, they weren't like pedagogues. They weren't like trying to educate their, you know, their listeners, but in some ways they were giving us all a course in the history of American music. And, you know, and in some ways Bill Graham was the same. You know, Bill Graham, he knew, like, I can remember going to see The Who, and I saw The Who three nights in a row, and Bill Graham had Woody Herman's big band with them. And, you know, and
you still have hearing.
Well, barely, yeah. No, we were sitting right in front with The Who too. And you know, and we'd go to see, you know, I can remember going to see The Airplane, and Bill Graham had Mongo Santa Maria. And the first and only time I went to the original Fillmore back in, it would have been late May of 68. So it was the Yardbirds would Jeff Beck have been playing lead or Jimmy Page? I think it was Jimmy Page. Your viewers can check me out there. But anyway, so it was, you know, It's a Beautiful Day, and, you know, they played. But Cecil Taylor was the opening. Now, Cecil Taylor, nobody, other than people who were coming to see Cecil Taylor, you know, I mean, this is avant-garde. This is like crazy jazz. And Bill Graham did that all the time. You know, he had these old blues guys who he would, you know, bring on to play with. He knew that the Dead or the Airplane or the Who or you know, Led Zeppelin or whoever was going to fill the place. So he could be an educator past that point. And he was. He had very diverse, you know, Pentangle. You know, I mean, hippies weren't going to go to see Pentangle. I mean, I wasn't. I'll just speak for myself. I wasn't going to go see Pentangle. But I was delighted to, you know, to be able to be educated in that kind of way.
Yeah, I don't know Pentangle or Cecil Taylor. I had to write him down.
Oh yeah, look up Cecil Taylor and you know, and Pentangle, and you know, a lot of those, like Bert Jansch and who did he play with? But you know, a lot of those really brilliant, brilliant British acoustic guitar players who, you know, the Garcias and the Claptons and all those people were listening to them and learning from them. And Bill Graham was, you know, kind of bringing them on to open. Yeah.
Did you ever catch Miles?
Miles Davis? You know, here's it. I didn't, and it, you know, I could have, and you know, and no, there was, you know, there were, I didn't, you know, the people I didn't see when I could have, you know, I didn't go to B.B. King. I didn't go to Albert King. You know, I was a little, you know, I started going just after, Otis Redding. You know, Bill Graham went all the way to Georgia to bring Otis Redding up. Mm-hmm. To, you know, to play in the Fillmore, and but that's another thing too. You know, he was, you know, he would go out of his way to try and, you know, expand the kind of the musical taste of the people who, you know, who were those audiences. But also he was being educated by, you know, this is interesting that, you know, people like Michael Bloomfield and Nick Gravanitis and, well, what's his name? Steve Miller, you know, these Chicago blues people who ultimately came and settled in the Bay Area. Bill Graham would go to them and say, well, who do I bring? Well, you bring Magic Sam, you bring James Cotton, you bring all these guys. And so Bill Graham just did that. And he let these folks kind of be their tutors. And I remember one of my favorite concerts was the very opening of the Fillmore West. It was July 1968. And it was the headliner was Paul Butterfield, and Paul Butterfield Blues Band. It was after Bloomfield had left, and then the second band was a group I had never heard of called 10 Years After, and then the opening was this group called Truth, and I'd never heard of Truth, but then there was a substitute band that I'd also never heard of, a little band from Great Britain called Fleetwood Mac. And Fleetwood Mac, this is when they were a blues band, right? It was before Stevie Nicks and all that. But, you know, it was Peter Green. And that's another example of how, you know, the blues people are telling Bill Graham, you know, Peter Green is like, he's big time. He's like, he's an Eric Clapton, and you got to bring him. And none of us had ever heard of him. But so, again, that sort of that educative role that Bill Graham was playing.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you know, all those seeds that got planted, I mean, obviously all over the country, but, you know, in the Bay Area. You know, now talking about Bill Graham, you know, the Rolling Stones should have listened to Bill Graham, that, you know, that they wanted to do the free concert at Altamont in December of 1969. And Bill Graham didn't want any part of it. You know, this is just not well planned. I'm not going to be part of this. The Dead, not to their credit, were going to be part of it in the airplane. And, you know, and actually, you know, the story gets told in different ways, but it may have been the airplane who suggested that Hell's Angels do security for the concert. But I went, I was going to school in Stockton. So it was just a short way away from the Altamont Speedway. And so, you know, Santana played and the airplane played and Flying Burrito Brothers. Who else? And the Dead were supposed to play, but the Dead just kind of, you know, walked away from it. And then after the airplane played, that was when the Stones, you know, they waited and waited and waited and waited, and they wanted it to get dark so that their lights would, and people had been there. I mean, we'd been there since like 6 or 7 in the morning, I think. And it was just a disaster waiting to happen. And it happened big time. So.
Yeah. I was just thinking about that when you were talking about the three bands, two sets each. That's a long time, not only for the band, but for the people that are watching.
Also, you know, yeah, good point. And also, you know, I don't know if you, so neither Winterland nor, you know, Fillmore West, they didn't have seats. It wasn't like Fillmore East. Fillmore East had seats, I understand. I've never been to the Fillmore East, but we didn't have any seats. It was all, you sat on the hard dance floor.
On the beer floor.
Well, whatever. Yeah. Yeah. And so, and you know, you would kind of rush in and you'd kind of get your seat. But then you'd sit, you know, first set, second set, third set, fourth set, you know, all the way through the evening. But, you know, it was, you know, we were young and you know, we were willing to, whatever it was. And I think it was $2.50 to get in, I think, to the carousel, I think. And I think Bill Graham might have raised it to even $3.50, I can't remember, but you know, it still was really reasonable. But you know, the thing about you know, I mean, it was just I thought that every place in the country, you know, that this was going on at the time. I didn't, you know, and because not only did we have, you know, the Fillmore, and then, you know, if it was a big band, like say Led Zeppelin would move over to Winterland for the weekend. But, you know, there was also the Avalon, and there were other, you know, there were, you know, places in Marin County, and there was still the Matrix. I saw Garcia there once at the Matrix, which, you know, there's a couple of wonderful Grace Slick and the Great Society albums recorded at the Matrix before she joined the Airplane. But anyway.
You didn't realize you were living in such a cultural and political mecca at the time?
I said a little bit, but I did think it was more widespread. I mean, I knew that it wasn't going on in Wyoming, let's say.
Still not.
But, and, you know, and I went down in the summer of 68, I went down to L.A. to spend time with my good friend Jim Green. And Jim was a year younger, but we went to the Whiskey A Go-Go to see Eric Burdon and the Animals. And it was a whole different scene. You know, it was like, you know, it was like a 2-drink minimum or whatever. And then we went to Santa Monica Civic Auditorium to see The Who. And that too was a different scene because, you know, there were seats. You could sit in a chair and watch them, which was, you know, for better or for worse. So, well, it was a wonderful time to be there. And, yeah.
You mentioned you worked for you worked with a nonprofit.
Well, yeah. I mean, back in the day, I mean, I was working with the Marin Peace Coalition, and you know, as we were talking earlier, you know, I think it bears, you know, emphasizing that there was a political dimension to all of this. And I remember one time standing in line at the Fillmore, and this would have been 68 because this guy had this McCarthy for President button, and realizing, you know, you could look at somebody. I mean, first of all, everybody who's coming to these, you know, people have long hair, you know what they think about, you know, legalization of marijuana, you know what they think about the war and the draft, and that in fact that there was as imperfect and as weird and often sexist and sometimes racist and all as it was, that there was this counterculture kind of brewing, this kind of, you know, defiant movement that, and that the music was a part of that. And, you know, and there was a more political part, like Country Joe and the Fish, you know, was a more kind of left-wing band, you know, that, you know, Feel Like I'm Fixing to Die Rag was, you know, explicitly anti-war. And some less, you know, explicitly political groups like the Grateful Dead. But, you know, the Airplanes volunteers, you know, and that so I think it's important to think about the music and the way in which it hooked in to a broader kind of sense of defiance and social justice and peace. That was just, yeah, it was an important piece. And so that there was a broader education going on. So as I was being pulled more into politics, I was also being pulled more into this whole, you know, counterculture at the same time. So you gave me an opportunity to kind of plug the organization that I work with. I'm the curriculum editor for Rethinking Schools magazine. Rethinking Schools is a quarterly magazine, focuses on critical issues in education from a social justice standpoint. And I also co-direct the Zen Education Project, which some of your viewers, listeners may be familiar with the book, A People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn. It's sort of the most prominent critical, you know, kind of grassroots teach the truth about U.S. history book. And so we offer free people's history curriculum for teachers who want to teach outside the textbook. And that's sort of our mission to provide that kind of resource. And also we try to offer a way for teachers who want to connect, you know, some of the social justice music work with that. So we encourage people to, you know, you can just go to the Zen Education Project and, you know, put in music and see the kind of the curriculum that comes up.
Awesome. Yeah, I'll put a link to that too. So people can check.
I did the teaching guide for the Sun City video. I don't know if you remember Little Steven, you know, who was the lead guitarist for E Street Band. And back in the 80s.
Do I have that record, man?
Yeah, you sure do. Yeah, it's a wonderful record, and it was on kind of regular play on MTV back in the day. But here, this is a song that I'm not going to play Sun City, because during apartheid in South Africa, the white regime was trying to lure musicians the same way that Israel is trying to lure musicians to offer legitimacy today, that the white South Africans were trying to lure, you know, famous acts. You know, Rod Stewart played there, Tina Turner played there. And so Little Steven and got this song together and got people to agree to be part of this music video, I'm Not Gonna Play Sun City. And with Bob Dylan and Lou Reed and Run DMC and Afrika Bambaataa and Ringo and Keith Richards and Bono. And it was just, you know, it was an amazing thing. And after that, by and large, nobody did play Sun City, because basically the whole progressive, you know, music movement, you know, said, no, this is not a cool thing. We don't offer, you know, Miles Davis was part of that. We don't want to, you know, lend our support to apartheid in South Africa. And, you know, and if you're, again, if you're listeners and viewers, you know, go back and look at that. I mean, Miles Davis is on it, and it's a whole album too. And I think Bono has a song on it. It's possible that Keith Richards has a song on it. But it was, you know, it was really, it was produced by, you know, by Little Steven Van Zandt, who, you know, who did so many, you know, great things during that period. And of course, Bruce Springsteen is part of that Sun City piece too.
Yeah.
Bonnie Raitt, don't want to forget Bonnie Raitt. She's on there. Jackson Brown, you know, and she's another one. You know, we were talking about kind of the educative role of musicians, and Bonnie Raitt really, you know, she lifted up so many African-American blues people, and, you know, just said, okay, you like me, you love what you listen to me, you know, let's listen to these other people too, you know, let's listen to John Lee Hooker, you know, and so she was always about kind of honoring, you know, where the music came from.
Right. So, okay, so obviously you've got great taste in music. So what's something you found lately that's struck you as something that the listeners should go out and check out?
Well, I'll tell you one, you know, Bombino. So I don't know if you've heard Bombino. So Bombino is from North Africa. And I think of Bombino is like the Jimi Hendrix of North Africa. And so Bombino, well, actually, I was going to go to the Portland, the Blues Festival, because I wanted to see Los Lobos. They were headlining this one evening, and Los Lonely Boys, and Bombino was sandwiched in between. And I got a detached retina. I don't know. Don't ever get one, because you have to lie on your side. You have to lie on your side for 7 days. And so I couldn't go out anywhere. But KBOO Radio, give a little shout out to KBOO Radio in Portland. They had the whole Blues Festival live. And so I was listening to Bombino. I thought, what the hell is this? This is like music I'd never heard before. And so it's like sort of traditional North African sound, but it's just, but it's got, you know, deep blues, and, you know, I just rock and roll too. And so, yeah. So listen to Bombino.
All right. I'll check it out for sure. Bill Bigelow, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Will, for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Hey now, do you have a great story about a Grateful Dead show you were at? I'd love to hear it and maybe have you on the podcast. Send me an email at will@talesfromthelot.org and let me know what show you would like to talk about and what made it so special to you.